Well, we've been interviewing Moses, if we could. And we've been asking questions like, Moses, what was it like to owe so much to so many? Moses, what was it like to have the best of both worlds? Moses, what was it like when you were faced with making choices? Moses, what was it like to go from being somebody to being a nobody? Moses, what was it like to be out of your comfort zone? Moses, what was it like to have a personal encounter with God? Moses, what was it like to get your marching orders? Moses, what was it like when going forward involves going back? Moses, what was it like to have faithfulness rewarded by a setback? Moses, what was it like to stand alone? Moses, what was it like to wrestle with ranks of evil? So we've been thinking about many, many things that Moses had to deal with in his life, and thinking about ourselves, and if we could speak to him, we would maybe ask, what was that like? And our question today is, Moses, what was it like to keep believing when surrounded by unbelief? At the beginning of the plagues or judgments, which were inflicted on the Egyptians, Moses was most certainly surrounded by unbelief. First of all, of course, his own kinsfolk, that vast nation, the children of Israel, the Israelites, the Hebrews, they dismissed him, thinking that he was more of a hindrance than a help, because as you know, when his first appeal to Pharaoh, instead of things getting better, things got worse for them. They just washed their hands of Moses and Aaron at that point. So they didn't believe. And they certainly didn't believe that Moses could deliver them. And probably, as Moses was God's only messenger, they were really saying as well, we don't believe that God's going to do it either. Then, of course, the Egyptians weren't interested in the God of the Hebrews. He just wasn't on their radar. So they didn't believe. Why would they? And then you had Pharaoh and his court, and they most certainly didn't take the word of God seriously. They didn't believe. So here's Moses surrounded by all of this unbelief. And yet, Moses believed. So Moses, what was it like to keep believing when surrounded by unbelief? Is that somebody here this morning? Is that you? Are you the only believer in your family? Are you the only believer in your house? Are you the only believer in your work? Are you the only believer in your street? Are you the only believer in your class? Do you feel that you're believing, but you're surrounded by unbelief? And you could take that a step further. You could take that into leadership. Are you the only one who has a vision, but you're surrounded by negativity? Is that someone here? Well, things were about to change. We often talk about the 10 plagues. But I would like to think about them in a wee bit more detail. We talked about reasons for the wickedness and evil that was behind what Moses faced in our last study. But today I want us to talk a wee bit more about the plagues. And I would like to present them not just as 10, but as 9 and 1. And there's a reason for that. I believe the Lord separates the last one right away at the beginning of all of these negotiations with Pharaoh, even before the others are unveiled. In fact, before Moses even reaches Egypt. Because we read in Exodus chapter 4 from verse 22, "And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, Thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And I say unto thee, Let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn." So God is saying that his people, collectively, are his son, and seen in that way. They're also seen in different pictures, but this is one that we find here. his firstborn. And he's saying, Moses, you have to go to Pharaoh with this message and tell Pharaoh that his firstborn is going to be slain. So the death of the firstborn is the only one mentioned specifically way before Moses even goes to Pharaoh. And it's unique. It's unique in its symbolism. And even the details that surround the death of the firstborn, they're very particular and say so much to us. So it stands alone. What about the other nine? Is there something that makes them a group and separates them? And I believe that is so. I believe there are three groups of three. The first three, the Nile turned to blood, the frogs and the lice. And in performing those supernatural things, there was the use of the rod in front of the magicians. Then the next three, the flies, the disease in the livestock, and the boils on their skin, no magicians were present, and the rod wasn't used. Then the third three, hail, locusts, and darkness, again no magicians were present, but sometimes the rod was used, and on one occasion a hand was used. So they are different. And there are subtle little differences there that we can see just in a very obvious way. But another way of looking at these nine as three threes is also to see them bookended between the miracle of the rods being turned into serpents and, of course, the death of the firstborn. Before the plagues begin, Moses and Aaron come before Pharaoh. They come with the rod, throw it down, it becomes a serpent. The magicians throw their rods down, they become serpents. But the serpent from the rod of Moses gobbles the others up. It's a foretaste of what's to come. One will triumph over all the others. Remember Pharaoh's response before any of this happens. Whenever Moses first comes to him, and just before he makes life harder for the Hebrews, this is the response of Pharaoh in Exodus 5 and 2. Let's remind ourselves of it. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. And yet, in that demonstration with the rods and the serpents, God was saying through Moses and Aaron that he will triumph. That one will triumph over all. And that the God of Israel will triumph over not only Pharaoh, but all the gods, small g, of the Egyptians. So with that in mind and thinking about these three sets of three, there's another reason for dividing them up. And that has to do with how God gave a warning through Moses and Aaron to Pharaoh. But on three occasions, the warning was also accompanied by a reason. And it happens at the beginning of each group of three. The first group of three, and the first sign, the first plague was the Nile being turned to blood. And we read in Exodus 7 and 17, in this shalt thou know that I am the Lord. So he warns that it's coming, but he gives a reason. He says, in this shalt thou know that I am the Lord. So then there are those three. Then, the beginning of the second group of three, we have the miracle or the plague of flies. And when that is prophesied, a reason is given, Exodus 8 from verse 22. That thou mayest know that I am the Lord, but that's not all. I am the Lord in the midst of the earth, and I will put division between my people and thy people. So the first group of three, the second group of three, and then in the last group of three, which begins with the miracle of the hail, we read in Exodus 9 and 14, a reason. that thou mayest know that there is none like me in all the earth. So, in the plagues that make the first group, God is saying, in this shalt thou know that I am the Lord. What's he saying? I'm powerful. Because in this, in the working of this, you will know that I am powerful. That's not all. The second group of three, the reason being, you'll know that I am in the midst of all the earth and will put division between my people and your people. He's saying to Pharaoh, you're going to know that I am present and unavoidable. And then with the last group of three, there is none like me. He's saying, not only am I powerful, not only am I present and unavoidable, but I am incomparable. That's our God, isn't it? He's powerful this morning. But here's the wonderful thing. He's also present. And although many in this world choose to write him out of their constitutions and law books, he's still unavoidable. It's appointed unto men once to die, but what? After this, the judgment. He's unavoidable. How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? And he's incomparable, because those of us who have come to realize this and who are trusting him and who love him with all our hearts, our soul and our mind, he's incomparable, isn't he? When we come to this feast, the end of our service, we have a Savior who's incomparable. And we do sing at times, don't we, Lord, there is none like you. No one ever cared for me like Jesus. And these plagues would testify to all of this. This is God's message to Pharaoh. Well, was that all that Pharaoh was hearing? Was he just hearing what God was saying through Moses and Aaron? No. And just like us in life, we don't just hear the one voice we should hear. We hear many voices. Even in this meeting this morning, you're hearing my voice. But you may also be hearing the voice of God to your heart. But you might also be hearing the old voice of the flesh. And it's very possible you'll be hearing the old voice of the devil as he disrupts and as he takes your mind off things. Isn't that so true? There are many, many voices that clamor for our attention. But we do know that Pharaoh also heard from his magicians or sorcerers. Remember that they were able to replicate the miracle of the snake and the rod. They were able to turn the water into blood. They were able to produce frogs. But they failed after that. We talked about the ranks of evil last week, didn't we? Didn't we talk about the devil being behind all this? But isn't it wonderful that the devil's limited? It's just like the time Satan came before God in the life of Job. And God was able to say, this far, but no further. Well, this is what the magicians say. And they say this to Pharaoh. So it's not just the voice of Moses and Aaron. In Exodus 8 and 19, this is what we read. Then the magicians said unto Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. And you know something? These people that he had rubbed shoulders with, he probably paid them. They were part of his court. He may have relied heavily upon them for predictions. And yet on this occasion, not only is he not listening to Moses and Aaron, but he's not listening to them either. And they've just said in front of him, and I believe it was a very courageous thing to do, this is the finger of God. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he listened not to them, just as the Lord had said. That's not all. Not only is he now hearing from them, but what about his own servants? So this is the wider court. It's still not a reference to all the Egyptians. It's those who were around him. The Lord sends Moses and Aaron to Pharaoh to warn him about the plague of hail that would be coming. Now, we're maybe comparing a beautiful day yesterday with a rather damp day today, but if you were going to go out there and be pounded by the hail that came in the days of Moses, you'd be better staying inside. And whenever they knew that was coming, we read this in Exodus 9 and 20. He that feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh. So, remember how all this started with unbelief? Remember I said things are about to change. Now they're starting to take the word of the Lord seriously. And those who did, they made all of their household staff and all of their cattle go indoors. Pharaoh's own servants fearing the word of the Lord. Then Moses and Aaron warned Pharaoh that the Lord is sending a plague of locusts to cover the land. Now, they hadn't arrived yet, but in Exodus 10 and 7, this is what we read. And Pharaoh's servant said unto him, how long shall this man be a snare unto us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Knowest thou not yet that Egypt is destroyed? They're looking around them at the devastation. And they're saying to Pharaoh, can you not see? These servants had suffered the effects of the judgment so far, including the boils on their skin. And here they are coming to Pharaoh. And again, it's a very courageous thing for them to say, but I guess they had nothing to lose. So devastating had been these plagues that they probably felt, we've nothing to lose. It was like the three lepers that sat outside the gate and said, why sit we here until we die? We've nothing to lose. We could only get killed and sure we're going to die with leprosy anyway. That's the attitude. So they also speak to Pharaoh. Do you see the case building? And the very pagan gods of Egypt, the false gods, the man-made gods, they were publicly affronted by God Almighty. And even their uselessness should have been a message to Pharaoh. All of this was speaking. And Pharaoh just continued, who is the Lord? Well, the Lord is going to push on and continue his program to let Pharaoh know exactly who the Lord is. Before this standoff, Egypt was looked to, this very prosperous nation in a most fertile land. That meant a very productive land, self-sufficient land. Complete at this particular time with a vast supply of cheap human labor in the form, of course, of the Hebrews, the Israelites. He had the veneration or obeisance or at least he had the fear of his subjects. But look at him now. A king over a ravaged landscape. A king over a country hit by a string of what today news commentators would call natural disasters. A king over a nation that was writhing with disease from man to beast. His confidence in his sorcerers had been shattered, and they're now telling him what he doesn't want to hear. His servants are now advising him to give in, but he finds that he just can't give in. He hasn't been beaten by some neighboring mighty king or coalition of kings. His integrity is gone. Why? He's been beaten by two insignificant Hebrews, elderly Hebrews, 80 and 83. Shepherds, despised Hebrews. But they're not on their own. Remember the first excuse Moses made? I'm not good enough. What was the Lord's response? Exodus 3 and 12. Certainly or assuredly, I will be with you. I like Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 1:25. We've already thought about this. But it applies at this very point. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men. God's no fool, but it's a comparison being made here. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, the weakness of God is stronger than men. God's not weak. It's a comparison. You see, your calling, brethren, how that not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. The base things of the world and the things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and the things which are not, to bring to naught the things which are. Here's the reason, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Pharaoh, what did you just say? Who's the Lord? Well, the Lord's showing you exactly who he is. And he's using the least. What a humiliation. Two elderly men, Hebrews, slaves. He has taken the least to bring down this great man. One man is now the barrier to the freedom of the Hebrews. Just one man. The nation are now no longer siding with Pharaoh. They want, you'll see that when we come to it. They just want the Israelites out. Get them out. In fact, we'll reach them all the valuables we have just to make sure they go and stay out. Pharaoh's servants are saying, get them out. The sorcerers, everybody is seeing it, but Pharaoh, it's down to one man. You know what that reminds me of? What Paul writes in Romans chapter 5 and verse 12 and also verse 19. As by one man sin entered the world, and death by sin, death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. And then as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. The importance of one. Only one sin makes you guilty of the whole law. Do you remember that? One man sin entered into the world. But by the obedience of one. Who's that? That's Jesus. You and I today can be made righteous. Moses, what was it like to keep believing when surrounded by unbelief? Well, eventually, he's just facing one stubborn unbeliever. I wonder how you would face someone like Pharaoh. Well, Moses intercedes for Pharaoh. I think this is interesting. In the middle of all of this, we can very easily, and it's often been portrayed about Pharaoh, or Moses standing there making all these pronouncements to Pharaoh, all these great booming warnings that this is going to come and you're going to know who God is and so on, and on it goes. But we often forget the detail that Moses actually intercedes for Pharaoh. We remember the compromises that Pharaoh tried to dangle in front of Moses, but he stood firm. But then he also asked Moses to intercede for him before the Lord. And this comes from Pharaoh. And he says to Moses, would you just intercede before the Lord and ask him to stop this plague, that plague, and the other plague? He even at times confesses his sin. And all of this has to be taken into consideration, of course, whenever you're tempted to look and quote the hardening of Pharaoh's heart as being one thing. It's many things. What would you do? What did Moses do whenever Pharaoh asked him to intercede before the Lord? Well, Moses prays to God. He pleads before the Lord, and those particular judgments cease an answer to prayer. You know what that reminds me of? Whilst we don't understand all that that entails, it reminds me of Jesus' words in Matthew 5 and 44. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and here's the little phrase, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Moses, what was that like? Because he could very easily have turned to God and said, Lord, destroy this monster. Lord, break him. And he could have called down any number of things to come as curses upon Pharaoh. Couldn't we do the same? Whenever we come against, even when we think about those in high office who are shaking their puny fists in the face of God and his word, how quickly we call down God's judgment on them. Who are we to do that? I'm only a sinner, you know. And there but for the grace of God go I. And it impacted me. Pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. You know, it's only whenever we read some of the stories of people like Corrie ten Boom and others, we discover what? They prayed for their oppressors. How easy would you find that? How easy would I find that? But you know something else? This is a further humiliation for Pharaoh. The humiliation of being indebted to Moses. You're inferior. And how he has called upon God to stop these plagues on your behalf. That's another humiliation for the great Pharaoh. And when God actually answers, Pharaoh still holds out. Exodus chapter 10 from verse 27, this is what we read. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. And Pharaoh said unto him, get thee from me. Take heed to thyself. See my face no more, for in that day thou seest my face, thou shalt die. And Moses said, thou hast spoken well. I will see thy face again no more. So even in spite of the fact that he asked Moses to do this, Moses did it and God answered. He says, I still want nothing to do with you. I don't want to see your face ever again. Wonder if there's somebody here or somebody you know. And whenever trouble comes, they're very quick to say, would you pray for me? And oddly enough, so often the Lord does answer that particular prayer. But where are they today? They're like the 9 lepers of the 10. The Lord healed them, but where are they? They didn't even say thank you. It's Pharaoh who makes this request, I don't want to see your face. It's not Moses and it's not God. Moses, what was it like to keep believing when surrounded by such unbelief? Of course, during this period, there aren't many times when the children of Israel are mentioned. And I mean the fact that Moses either spoke to them or that they were involved in any way. During these plagues, we don't really read much about them. We don't know about their reaction. But remember the Lord's explanation to Pharaoh in Exodus 8 and verse 22, that thou mayest know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth, and I will put division between my people and thy people. What's he really saying there? I'm going to let you see there's a difference. Just to sidetrack for 1 second, Is there a difference in you and me and the rest of the world today? Remember, Egypt's a picture of the world. Is there a difference in you and me? Do people around us know that, oh, there they are, they're heading for church today? Do people around us know that there's somebody who cares? Do the people we interact with know, even by our very language, there's a respectable person who honours the God they say they love? Is there a difference? There should be a difference, but I'm convinced that we're living in the Western world more and more and more in a manner that there's less of a difference between the world and the church. The world is in the church and the church is in the world. It doesn't have to be like that. So how do we see that playing out in these plagues? Well, the plague of flies, Exodus 8 and 22. And this is God speaking. I will make a division in the land of Goshen. That's where the Hebrews dwelt. And no flies shall be there. God's making a difference. Now you imagine if you're a Hebrew, you're going to start to see something, aren't you? God's doing this to the Egyptians, but we're being spared. Then the death, or the disease rather, in the livestock, Exodus 9 and 4. And the Lord shall sever again, he'll mark out a line between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt. And there shall nothing die of all that is the children of Israel's. Then the boils. These lesions on their skin, whatever form they took, it was suffering anyway. Exodus 9:11. And the boil was upon all the Egyptians. There's a difference. Then there's the heel. Exodus 9:26. Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, was there no heel. Then there's the locusts, Exodus 10 and 6, that they would be only in the houses of the Egyptians specifically. They'd be over the land, but they would only get into the houses of the Egyptians specifically. And I love this one, the darkness, Exodus 10 and 23. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. I don't know how that was done, but the whole land was full of darkness. And yet the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. We're living in a dark world, aren't we? Darkness in the sense of extreme evil. Darkness in the sense of ignorance to God and his word. Oh, we're not just in here with artificial light. Sure we're not. We're in here with Jesus, the light of the world. We're in here with the light of the Spirit of God. We're in here with the light of the word of God. Isn't it great to be walking in the light? Children of light. Delivered from darkness. And God, who could do that physically in Egypt, has done that for us in a greater way. So he's sending a powerful message not only to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh, but also to the children of Israel. Although there's no specific mention made that that is so, we can see it would definitely be the case. They weren't listening to Moses. But God was speaking nonetheless. Do you know, in our lives, there are times we don't listen as Christians. And God does have to speak through other things. And the same powerful God that was able to do those things is able to do powerful things in our lives as well. Only sadly, sometimes they have to be real earthquakes, storms in our life. Just like a plague. That shake us up because we're not tuned in to the voice of the Lord. God was being good to his people, even whilst judging the others. And there's a pattern emerging that maybe helps us when we come to our eschatology. God, of course, must judge, but he's being good and makes a division regarding his people. Noah, God judged, but he took his people out. Lot, God judged Sodom and Gomorrah, but he took those people out. His judgments didn't touch his remnant. But there's more than that. He eventually does have a word directly for the Hebrews. In chapter 10, the end of verse 2, speaking to the Israelites at that present time, but he's speaking to them about the generations that would come after them. So there's a great promise. Because there, they're going to discover, right, we are going to continue to live. And this is what he says to them, that ye may know that I am the Lord. It's one thing saying that to Pharaoh. Isn't it a sad job when God has to say that to his people? That ye may know that I am the Lord. Again, speaking to those present Israelites at that moment in time, in Exodus 11 this time, in verse 7, he says, that ye may know how that the Lord doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. You're different. But he's also saying to those people at that particular time, in that day, you've suffered enough. And there are many times when God had to chasten his people, had to correct them. And he used other nations to do that. But do you know something? Those other nations never ever got away with it. And that will always be so. And then we come to the last plague, the standalone judgment, the death of the firstborn, so different from all others. But here's the thing. Moses, what was it like to be surrounded by unbelief and yet to keep believing? His people were some of the greatest unbelievers. But they were going to have to believe and trust the word of Moses and Aaron if they were going to survive Passover night. They were going to have to believe. There was going to be no exclusion with that one as there was with the others. The Lord would pass through the land and the destroyer would take all the firstborn of human and beast in every household. And this time, instead of God saying it's only going to touch the Egyptians and not touch the Israelites, God says, I'm going to teach you something as well. You're going to have to start a journey into the wilderness, a journey with God. And you need to learn a lesson, and it is belief. You're going to have to believe Moses and Aaron. You're going to have to apply the blood. You're going to have to shelter underneath the blood. Because if you do, you'll be safe. If you don't, the destroyer will come to you too. It wasn't just going to be a corporate national belief. It was going to have to be a personal belief. And our time has just gone, and I would love to go into that, but we'll have to leave that there for now. And we'll be thinking then about the death of the firstborn when we come, in the Lord's will, to speak on this again.